Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We're going to start in Acts 21. That's when Paul arrives in Jerusalem. We're also on page 242 of the framework books. The year is 57 AD. It's the bottom year listed there on page 242 of the framework book, where Paul's arriving in Jerusalem. Remember, we got there's going to be like a series of 15 days that are listed there, day one, day two, day three. Several chapters cover that. And then on the next page, page 243, you've got a map from Caesarea, or going from Jerusalem, going from to Caesarea all the way to Rome, which you're going to take for the rest of the book of Acts. You really won't need that map until maybe next week, probably. But as far as tonight, we just got the events in the year 57 and 58 AD, and that's going to be Paul is going to be in prison. So I'd like to have you open your Bibles to chapter 21 of Acts. And as we know, Paul has left Ephesus, sailed across the Mediterranean Sea. He's arrived at Caesarea, and there he is going to go from Caesarea. He's going to go on into Jerusalem. And so in chapter 21, verse 17, it says this: "When we arrived at Jerusalem, the brothers received us warmly." Again, that would be the church. The next day, and this is day one, as we talked last week, and this first part is a little bit of a review from Paul arriving in Jerusalem. There's day one, day two, day three, so you see how quickly things progress here. So on the first day, Paul, it goes on and says, the next day, day one, Paul and the rest of us went to see James, that's Jesus' brother, he's the head of the church in Jerusalem, and all the elders were present. And we maybe could assume John is there and other leaders of the church, or maybe a couple other of the apostles may be there. But many people that had seen Jesus or knew Jesus personally would be in that meeting. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So he talks about everything that's been taking place up in, you know, Asia, up in Macedonia, Greece, and all the things that God is doing with the Gentiles by simply preaching faith in Christ. And remember, last week, I kind of went negative right here on the Jerusalem church because they're trying to accommodate, you know, how are we going to get Paul accepted by the Jerusalem church who's still in a Jewish mode. And again, there's some tension here between the Jerusalem church and the Gentile church, or the Jewish church and the Gentile church. And it was addressed early on in the book of Acts in 48 AD when they wrote at the Jerusalem Council, when they wrote the letter and told the Gentiles in all the... I'm pointing like I've got a map here and I don't have a map. But all the Gentile churches had Jews in it, and they said, if you're going to fellowship with the Jews, these are some things you're going to want to follow. And they gave them a list of four things, not necessarily Mosaic laws, but things that if you're going to fellowship with the Jews, you're going to want to avoid these kind of confrontations. Well, now they're telling Paul this. Here's what they tell Paul, and you be the judge if it's positive or negative, but nonetheless, this is what the text says. After Paul talked about his ministry to the Gentiles and how God is showing grace to the Gentiles, they said in verse 20, when they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, you see, brother, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law. So again, we've got some Jews who are believers in Jesus Christ also, but they're still zealous for the law. They haven't separated from that. They have been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or live according to our customs. What shall we do? They will certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have made a vow. Take these men, join with them in their purification rites, and pay their expenses. Like I said last week, kind of like buying drinks for this group right here. These guys with me, I'll buy their meals or something. Pay for their vows. So they can have their heads shaved. Then everybody will know there's no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the law. So go up on the Temple Mount and make a show so everybody can see that you're living in obedience to the law that they say you're no longer following, and the law that they say that you're telling the Jews in Gentile lands not to follow. As for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they should abstain from food sacrificed idols. Now this verse 25, that's referring to 48 AD when they wrote the Jerusalem letter, and that's James wrote that and sent it with Paul and Barnabas back to the Gentile churches, and we've read that already earlier in Acts. Verse 25, as for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they should abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality, so that we maintain fellowship with Jews and Gentiles in Gentile lands. Now, Paul, if you'll do this, we'll be able to maintain fellowship with you and the Jewish church. Sounds good to Paul. So verse 26, the next day Paul took the men, the four, purified himself along with them. Then he went to the temple to give notice of the date when the days of purification would end and the offering would be made for each of them. And that's going to be a 7-day vow. They're going to take a vow for 7 days. So they wait 7 days. Verse 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. So these are Jews from up in Asia. They'd probably seen Paul in their cities. You know, he'd been stoned in an Asia church where they stoned him in Lystra. He'd caused problems where he'd gone through, you know, Antioch, Pisidian, and caused trouble in their synagogues. He'd had trouble in Ephesus and other places with the Jews. So they recognize him. Again, not that Paul's doing anything wrong, but he's not teaching what they want him to teach or presenting the truth the way they want it presented. So they recognize him, and they're Jews from the province of Asia. They've come down to Jerusalem to worship for a season, and they're going to return. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him. So now Paul gets arrested. Remember how he was told by the Spirit and by the prophet, don't go to Jerusalem. The man who goes to Jerusalem, this will happen to him. So he's on the Temple Mount. Day one, he goes, takes a vow, has to be separated for 7 days, comes back to the Temple Mount a week later, and the first thing that happens to him is what? No preaching, no teaching, no contact with the Jews. He gets arrested. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place." So he's teaching against our people, he's teaching against our law, and he's teaching against our temple. "And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." So he's brought them across the boundary where Gentiles can't go. And technically now the temple has to be shut down and everything has to be purified. Just like in the days of the Maccabean revolt when Antiochus Epiphanes offered a pig on the altar, everything had to be shut down until they could reform it and clean it. And same thing here. Everybody's got to shut down the temple today because it's been defiled by the presence of a Gentile. Or so they are told. They're just trying to start a riot is what they're trying to start. They had previously Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul, and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. Now, indeed, many Gentiles had come down with Paul from Macedonia, from Achaia, from Ephesus, from Asia. We get their names. They traveled with him. So there are Gentiles from Asia and Greece with him. But Paul knows the law. He's not going to take, especially when he's trying to make peace with the Jews, he's not going to violate it. And there's no indication here that he violated the temple precincts. But they saw Trophimus with him, a Gentile from Ephesus, so they assumed he was with him. That's what they're going to go with. The whole city was aroused, not just the Temple Mount area, not just around the temple, but the whole city is up in arms. The temple's got to get shut down. The temple's going to be shut down. Sacrifices, everybody's got to leave the temple area. It's impure. It's unclean. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Who would allow this type of thing to happen? They're very protective of their temple. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut because no one's going in. We got to purify it. While they were trying to kill him, they drug him out of the temple court. Now they're trying to kill him. News reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. Now, if you can picture the Temple Mount, I've got some names written up here that I should probably have left until maybe even next week. But here's the Temple Mount right here, Mount Moriah, that's again, there's the temple sitting right here. There's gates coming up to the temple right here that you can come in underground. There's gates up here with a bridge. We call it Robinson's Arch. You got Wilson's Arch coming into the temple up here. So there's ways of getting up onto this Temple Mount. But right up here is what is called Fort Antonia. It's a Roman citadel. It's a Roman station. It's a fortress. And they from here, they can see down. They're looking down on the platform. It's a very large area, and there's battalions of soldiers in here, and there's a riot up here. The Jews are riding on the Temple Mount. They've got Paul. They're trying to kill Paul. And when the Romans see this, again, remember Roman policy, you can rule yourself. Just make sure you keep peace, keep order. And whenever, if it's in Ephesus, if it's in Philippi, if it's in Jerusalem, if there's a riot, it's out of control, that's when the Roman soldiers move in and they take control. If you can rule yourself, they're just watching. They're just watching. They're just letting the Jews be Jews. They don't care who you worship, and especially in Jerusalem, just do your thing. But if you start a riot and we lose law and order, the Romans are going to move in. And that's about what's to take place. The Jews have started a riot just like they wanted. They want a big commotion. Verse 31, while they were trying to kill him, the Jews trying to kill Paul up on the Temple Mount, News reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. And that would have been right up here at Fort Antonia. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd, coming from here, down into the temple courts. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Whoa, they realized this is serious. The Romans were merciless. They could let you have peace, let you control your own city. But the minute they got involved, we're not going to go to level one, level two, level three. We're going to level four right away. They're coming down to take charge. So everybody backs off of Paul. The commander came up and arrested him, Paul, and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Now, again, he thinks Paul is somebody else. He thinks he's a terrorist from Egypt. He thinks he's someone that's come here to cause problems. He thinks he's on the most wanted list. He thinks we finally caught one of these guys, and that's what we've been looking for. So they arrest him. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing and some another. Typical riot crowd. No one really knows what's going on. We're just rioting. Again, we saw that in Ephesus. We saw that other places. And some answered another. And since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, because of the riot that's going on, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. Boom, the barracks are in Fort Antonia. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great, he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him!" So as their steps coming off the Temple Mount leading up into Fort Antonia, you can see a few of the stones from the Fort Antonia yet today. You can still see the some of the stones that remain of the foundation of that. And there are some, if you'd say, the bedrock stones are involved in it. I could tell you more. You can also see the beams that come out of the bedrock that would hold up the colonnade that goes all the way around, the walkway, the covered walkway that goes all the way around the temple. You can still see where the beams set in squares, pockets, about this big, you know, probably, I don't know how deep, where the beams would have set in and then stood on pillars out here going all the way down the colonnade. So the colonnade, you know, maybe about this long or wide, you could walk like this all the way around the temple court in a covered colonnade or covered sidewalk. And you can still see the remains of that here and some of those foundation stones. They're the stones of Fort Antonia in the wall today. They've got some pine trees growing up over, trying to cover it up so you can't see it very clearly. Anytime something like that's discovered, there's a group over there that tries to destroy the evidence. I don't want to say any more, but nonetheless. Some people don't want that to be known. Anyway, he reached the steps. The whole crowd is hollering, "Away with him." So they had to carry Paul above the crowd up these steps to get him because the Jews are still grabbing at him. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, now get this. Remember Ephesus? Even the magistrates in Ephesus sent messages to Paul, "Paul, stay home." Because Paul wanted to go where during the riot? Into the theater. If I just have a chance to talk with everybody, I will be able to make sense to them. So Paul, thinking like Paul, and that's why Paul's the great apostle, because he figures, just give me a chance to speak, I'll fix this. So they've got to carry him out of the crowd. The crowd is still reaching up trying to grab him. The intention is to kill him. They're shouting away at him. And as they're carrying, before he loses this crowd, his last moment in front of this crowd, verse 37, as the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you?" "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Meaning, whoa, you're speaking Greek? You don't sound like an Egyptian. Now do notice this verse right here, just for later reference. In Matthew 24, when Jesus says, when they say he's in the inner rooms or he's out in the desert, don't go, don't believe them, because he'll come like the sign of the sun, like lightning from the east to the west. When it says in the inner rooms, I struggled with this, you know, not struggle, but, you know, I just thought it was, what are they talking about? The inner rooms most likely is inner rooms. That's where the government officials would meet and they'd negotiate peace treaties. So they say the Messiah has returned. He's in making a treaty right now, like the Antichrist will do. He'll go make a treaty with the Jews and give them 7 years on the Temple Mount and make a peace treaty. When they say he's in the inner rooms, that's not Christ. That's not his return. Or when they say he's in the wilderness or the desert, it's like, who would think the Messiah's in the desert? What would the Messiah be doing in the desert? Well, this is where the wars start, right? This is exactly it right here. Who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago. If you're getting ready to attack the city of Jerusalem, You're going to go outside the city in the wilderness somewhere, gather your troops, get yourself organized, and march on the city. It's happened through the centuries. That's how you attack a city. You go out somewhere outside, gather your troops, and march on it. So what Jesus is saying, if they say, I'm in the inner room making a peace treaty, no, I'm not. If they say, I'm in the wilderness gathering my troops to march on the city, no, I'm not. Because it'll be like lightning from the east to the west. You'll see me coming back, and it won't be making a peace treaty, and it won't be gathering an army. I'll come back myself. So that may be just a little insight into that verse in Matthew 24. And here's an example of someone that they thought Paul was an Egyptian terrorist gathering groups who led a revolt, who was gathering troops in the desert that had escaped, kind of like a Osama bin Laden type guy that no one could find in the hills or the wilderness. They thought they finally caught him here on the Temple Mount. Paul answered, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. He says, I am a citizen, and it's not just an average Roman city. It's a Roman city. It's an extraordinary Roman city, and I'm a citizen of that city. He says, citizen of no ordinary city. Now, here's his whole point. Please let me speak to the people. I mean, you've got a riot. You got Roman troops fighting to get Paul out of the riot. They're trying to kill him. And he finally gets the... Again, Paul's got to have some kind of personality, some kind of charisma about him. I'm not saying it's glorious. I'm not saying he's a large man. He's got a booming voice. Nothing like that. But there's something about his disposition that in the midst of being carried... Listen, if I'm being grabbed and they're trying to kill me on the Temple Mount, and the only reason they stop and the Roman troops come down and they grab me, and as they're carrying me away, the crowd is still grabbing at me, trying to kill me, shouting, away with him, we hate him, and they're carrying me away to safety. The commander thinks I'm a terrorist. Am I going to have the ability to be able to communicate in that situation to the commander and say, I'd like to speak to the crowd? Could you stop that kind of momentum that's leading you away? I mean, Paul was able to get the commander's attention, have a conversation with him, clarify his identity, and then say, I'd like to speak with these people that are trying to kill me right now. Can I just have a moment with the crowd? And the Roman commander goes, great idea. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, it's like, I mean, just no matter how this turns out, that kind of a personality to be able to change the direction of a public riot like that, with no weapons, with just a personality, just with a presence. And again, you know, I know he's anointed, I know he's an apostle, but again, think about it just as a man in that situation. What I would be doing is, get me out of here! I'd be glad to get into the barracks. And just before you go into safety, like, wait, before I'm safe, give me one more chance to talk to the mob. Well, that's what Paul does. Please let me speak to the people. Having received the commander's permission... You're kidding me. The commander goes, oh, the Roman commander, who his afternoon lunch had been interrupted, had to come down here and solve this revolt, now says, oh, sure, go ahead. We'll just stand here and let you speak to the crowd. Paul stood on the steps going up to Fort Antonia, and motioned to the crowd, and they all draw quiet. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic. So he speaks Greek to amaze the Romans. Oh, you're not Egyptian. No, I'm not. I'm from Cilicia. I'm from Tarsus. Now he's on the Temple Mount. He's speaking Aramaic, which again is their language. You'd think he'd speak Hebrew, but they don't speak Hebrew. Their scriptures are in Hebrew, but a lot of their scriptures are in Aramaic. Jesus spoke Aramaic. That's the native language at this time. Does that make sense? That they spoke. That was the cultural language, was Aramaic. So he goes from Greek into Aramaic. And says, now I'm just going to try and read through this fairly quickly because you know most of this information. But this is his speech. This is his speech into a Jewish crowd. This is his chance that he's been fighting for to get to speak to the Jews. He's got an audience on the Temple Mount, and now he's going to get to present to them the gospel. Here we go. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Then Paul said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city under Gamaliel. I was thoroughly trained. Remember, he's a great, great teacher, even remembered yet today. Trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of the way to their death. Again, that's kind of one of the few times we find out specifically that he was actually killing them. We have these murderous threats and things in other references. Right here, he says, I was taking them to their deaths, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison, as also the high priest and all the council can testify. Now, this wasn't way, way back in the day. When he says the high priest, that high priest that's coming out of the temple right now can testify, you remember me. I mean, you don't even need to remember me. We know each other. And those that are on the council, the Sanhedrin, you guys know what I was doing. I mean, this is not like, who is this guy? When he steps up and starts talking, they know he was one of their number one hitmen. I even obtained letters from them. They gave him documentation from them to their brothers in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. You know the story. He's going to go to Damascus, arrest some Christians, bring them back and try them before the high priest and have them thrown in prison. So, I mean, this whole system, this was just a few years ago. Well, we're talking 57 A.D. Paul was doing this in 35 A.D. So you're talking 22 years. I mean, yeah, that's a long time, but these are still the same people. Then he goes on in verse 6, about noon as I came near Damascus, this is his testimony, I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? I asked. I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting, he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. What shall I do, Lord? I asked. Get up and go into Damascus. There you'll be told all that you have been assigned to do. My companions led me by the hand into Damascus because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. A man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law, meaning he's going to plug that in. He was a Jewish believer and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me. Now, he doesn't say that he was a Christian or a believer in the Messiah. He says he was an observer of the law, highly respected by the Jews. So this is one of your own guys that the Lord brought me to. He stood beside me and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. At that very moment, I was able to see him. Then he said to me, The God of our fathers has chosen you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear words from his mouth. So all of this is still Jewish. The God of our fathers. He's not saying Jesus. He's saying the God of our fathers, this is what Ananias says, has chosen you to know his will and to see the righteous one. Who is the righteous one? This would be the Son of God. This would be the Messiah, the Christ, which we know as Jesus. But you're still Jewish. See, we're still Jewish. There is the Holy One and there is his Son. There is that one that comes riding on the clouds of glory. You will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now, what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on his name. Now, notice the Jews are still listening. This is not a synagogue service where you're just being polite, waiting for the service to get over. This is a riot who's been brought to a hush because Paul started speaking Aramaic to them and telling them this story. And he's already pushing the boundaries of what they're going to tolerate. But they're still with him. Verse 17, when I returned to Jerusalem, I was praying. And then do notice, he has mentioned the name Jesus once. He has mentioned Jesus, because that's who the voice identified. I'm Jesus of Nazareth. When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, he's back in the temple. Now here's a vision you don't know a lot about. But here's one of the visions. He says, I was at the temple. I fell into a trance and saw the Lord speaking. Quick, he said to me, leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me. Now, this is when they put him on a ship and he sailed up to Antioch. You remember that? And he went further up in back to the Cilicia. This is recorded earlier in Acts. Please notice right here, Jesus, while Paul is on the Temple Mount earlier, say 35, 36 A.D., well, you go 3 years after that, maybe 38 A.D., he's on this same Temple Mount worshiping, and the Lord appears to him and says, quick. Now, you don't often hear the Lord saying, quick. A lot of times he says, peace, do not be afraid. But he comes and he goes, quick. It's like when the Lord shows up and goes, quick, that's a whole different scenario than, peace be with you, do not fear, everything's going to be fine. It's like, quick, Paul, you got to get out of here. I just thought that was funny. You may not. Anyway, he says, quick. He says, leave Jerusalem immediately and we'll come back some 20 years later and try it again. No, he says, quick, leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me. They are not going wrong place, wrong people, wrong time. Go somewhere else. Now, understand, Paul is, that's what Jesus said. I'm just playing this up with last week, too. He's now fought his way back to have a second shot at this. And even in his own testimony, he's testifying, the Lord told me to leave. These people won't ever listen to me. Lord, I replied, these men know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. I mean, these people know that I'm not on your side. I've got an in with the high priest. I've got an in with the Sanhedrin. They know that if I've changed, things are real. They will believe me. Then the Lord said to me, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. Verse 22, that's where he loses them. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voice and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. In other words, so far they're still toying with the idea, okay, he's coming to the Jews, he's on the temple, everything. He says, I'm going to send you to the Gentiles. Okay, no, that's not our God. That's not the Lord. That's not the God of our fathers. Wrong religion. Get rid of him. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, this is a public demonstration of fury, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. That's where they were headed originally. He directed, now watch this, he directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. Once again, Rome likes peace. All of a sudden, Paul steps up, speaks Aramaic, the crowd goes hush. The commander goes, oh, this is all right, this is what we like. Okay, this is well under control, so I'll just kind of step back. And all of a sudden, Paul says about, go to the Gentiles, and the whole crowd went berserk. It's like, well, Paul, whatever you said, I'm going to punish you and find out what you said to these people. And he drags them out, and they're going to get ready to beat Paul in Fort Antonia. As verse 25, as they stretched him out to flog him, I mean, they're tying him up right now to stretch him out, and he's been in this position five other times. He's been flogged like this five other times, so he knows what's about to happen. Paul said to the centurion standing there, again, look at the coolness. I mean, if you're getting ready to flog me, I'd be like, oh, no, or something like that, I would assume. I've never been flogged before, but I have pinched my finger in a door and hit my thumb with a hammer, and I know what I sound like. I don't sound calm. As they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? When the centurion, again, this is not the commander, this is a centurion under the commander, he'd be in charge of 100 men. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He said, this man is a Roman citizen. So now the centurion goes back to the commander, says he's a citizen. Now notice how serious they take their citizenship. Even in Jerusalem, from far, far away from Rome, this man's a citizen. You've got him stretched out to be whipped. I mean, that might be enough. Remember in Philippi when they found out Paul and Silas were citizens, how everybody just backed off and they tried to appease them. Here's the same thing. They've got him stretched out. They may have already gone too far. The commander went to Paul and asked him, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Yes, I am, he answered. Now, again, just something in my mind right here, I want to see paperwork. I mean, he's just Paul running around saying, I'm a Roman citizen. People have said that Paul would carry, you know, they've got letters, they've got papyrus, they've got documents, they've got genealogies recorded. So it's not unlike that Paul would have some kind of Roman certification, you know what I'm saying, like some paperwork. But I kind of would like to see that pop up here. Can I see your passport? Can I see your identification? Can I see some documentation? But they simply say, all that's recorded here is just, are you a citizen? Maybe people were more honest back then. I don't know. I mean, but it just, and he says, yes, I am. Then the commander says, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship, meaning I had to buy it. Paul says, but I was born a citizen. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. All of a sudden, they're not listening to the commander anymore. It's like, we don't want to be in any photographs. And boom, they just vanished. They're not going to be in, no one's having, who were those men? I don't know, they're gone. So now that it's the commander and Paul, and anyone that was there has disappeared from the scene because they know the seriousness of taking a Roman citizen and punishing them illegally, just like in Philippi. And again, you wonder, Paul had, why he wasn't thinking in Philippi. Maybe he should have played the citizenship card earlier in Philippi and avoided that whole beating. But that worked out. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. He had never hit him. They'd beat him yet, but they had put him in chains, a Roman citizen. And just that's pretty, I mean, isn't that amazing how honored that position is by the Roman government, the Roman army, military? Okay. Verse 30. The next day, now this would be day 8 or day 9 of Paul arriving in Jerusalem. So we're not real sure. You got the first day, the second day, the 7 days, and now we're at day 8 or 9. The next day. So the next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he still wants to know, who are you? Why? You're not the terrorist. You have good language skills. You know the high priest. You're familiar with it. He says, what is going on here? He released him and ordered the chief priest, okay, that's the high priest, that'd be Ananias, and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. So these are the people that had accused Jesus, but now they're assembling under the order of the Romans. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So now Paul is standing in front of the Sanhedrin. There's a good chance this place that they're meeting, it could be up here on the Temple Mount, some here in Solomon's Colonnade, kind of where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is at today on the south side. Or it could be off the western wall somewhere. They have found a large mikveh right in this area here, underground down by the tunnels. And it's a public building. And a large mikveh, meaning it's a place where many people could, but it's very decorated. It's not necessarily a public mikveh or bath or wash, baptismal. Not baptismal site, but a wash site. But it's a public building, so it looks like it could maybe be the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin may have met right here. Of course, we don't know, but they're in their official meeting place. And they may have excavated, well, at least they've got excavated something that was used at this time for public meetings. Paul may be there. But the Sanhedrin and the high priest assemble because the Romans say, we want to find out what's going on here. So you see the Sanhedrin working with the Romans again, and Paul is now in a position very similar to what Jesus was in. Verse chapter 23, Paul is not, do not even think, again, maybe so, but this is not unfamiliar territory for Paul. In fact, he's finally back on his home turf. He did a fantastic job marching through Asia, going through Galatia. He's gone through Philippi. He's talked to the Athens. He's gone to Corinth. He's been in front of Galileo, the proconsul in Achaia. He's been in front of all kinds of leaders and all kinds of Gentile positions that he's been in. Now he's in front of the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, which is a very powerful group, but these are people that he went to school with. Some of these guys, the Sanhedrin group, you've got to understand, he grew up with them. They may have been the same classes with him when he was studying with Gamaliel. He should be on that council. If he would have stayed true to his Jewish roots, he'd be one of those Sanhedrin members, potentially. I mean, I can't say for sure. But again, he's in his zone. And this is his great opportunity. He is not by any means worried. If he can play a crowd, he can play this crowd. So he's got the high priest there who used to give him permission and letters, documentation. He's got the Sanhedrin and many of these guys he knows personally. First chapter 23, Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. I am not guilty. I'm doing what God wants me to do." At this, the high priest Ananias, which Paul knows, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. So he says, what I've done in good conscience before God. And Ananias says, strike him. So the people that were kind of like the guards, the I don't know what you want to call them, watching him at the podium, slapped him. Now here's an interesting verse right here. And I'm going to give you, you may have it in your notes, so I've just got in my NIV footnotes here. Here's what Paul's response to the high priest ordering him to slap him. Do you remember when they slapped Jesus? Now, this is just worth mentioning. I mentioned it earlier. They slapped Jesus at his trial, and Jesus didn't turn the other cheek. He says, when they slapped him, once I turned the other cheek, remember what Jesus did. He asked him, why did you strike me? He says, I haven't even been accused of anything. You're striking me to make me confess my own guilt, which I'm not going to do because I'm not guilty. So why did you strike me? You strike a guilty man. You don't strike a man to force a confession out of him. So just notice how Jesus turned the other cheek. When Jesus was struck in the face, he didn't turn the other cheek and says, hit me again, sir. he challenged the high priest and says, he says, now that's completely out of line. That's not just. That's not the high priest's responsibility. You're slapping me like I'm a criminal when I haven't even been accused of anything. Watch Paul. They slap Paul. I'm sorry. This is Paul. Then Paul said, Ananias, the high priest, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Meaning, again, he's not even guilty of anything yet. And yet he sits there to judge him according to the law of Moses, but violates the law of Moses by striking a man who's not been accused of anything. He pulls the same accusation that Jesus does. The high priest is just slapping people around. And both Jesus and Paul say, whoa, you can't strike me. I haven't been accused of anything. Now, that's interesting. Verse 4, he just told the Jewish high priest, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Now, that whitewashed wall goes back to Ezekiel talking about prophesying and Ezekiel's prophecies about how the leadership of Jerusalem was just like a flimsy wall that was collapsing. It was going to cave in, but they just kept putting paint on it, making it look nice. That's what he's saying right here. You are a collapsing civilization, and they just keep putting paint on you, making you look nice, you whitewash wall. Meaning you think you've got a position of power, but you're just being held up by paint. That's what he's saying to him right there. And again, realize if this is 57 A.D., we got 13 years, Jerusalem will be in smoldering. In 11 years, the Jewish wars will begin, and this whole place is going to be coming down. So, I mean, their culture is just very, very flimsy. But anyway, he calls him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Verse 4, those who were standing near, Paul said, you dare to insult God's high priest? Now Paul says, brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. So this is, for me right here, this is, you have to decipher this. You have to unravel this. Because Paul, I'm cheering for Paul for mouthing off to the high priest. And he calls him a whitewashed wall. Now, who else is going to be giving a command in front of the Sanhedrin to have someone struck? And he calls him a whitewashed wall, which is what Ezekiel calls the leadership of Jerusalem back in the day for being just flimsy and being held up by paint. I mean, the connections is clear. You've got to believe Paul knows who he's talking to. I mean, the high priest doesn't come in jeans and a T-shirt to the Sanhedrin. He's dressed up. I mean, I could probably recognize the high priest. If I didn't know him, it's kind of like, I think that guy with the robe on the crown, I think that's the high priest. You know what I'm saying? I'm not even Jewish. So here's the thing. Then he says, I did not realize he was the high priest. And then he quotes scripture to accuse himself. Because it says, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. He says, I should not have said that about the ruler of my people. Okay. Now, in the notes underneath here, there's four reasons. You may have some notes similar to this. Because why? What's going on here? And no one knows for sure. I mean, you can maybe commit to one of the options. You maybe have an answer to this. But at least it's an interesting conversation. When he says, I did not realize this was the high priest, is explained, it says, in four different ways. Number one, Paul had poor eyesight. He couldn't see. I didn't know who was saying that. Well, again, I don't go with that one because you're in front of the Sanhedrin. Who else is going to be giving orders to strike the prisoner? It's going to come from the high priest. But that could be it. Paul can't see very good. Okay. Number two, he failed to discern that the one who presided was the high priest because on some occasions others had sat in his place. So in other words, maybe someone else was sitting in that place because the high priest was away on business or something. And that had occurred. So then Paul's just mouthing off to the high priest's representative, which, I mean, you know, if the police officer pulls you over, but it's not really the police officer, it's a deputy, it's like, well, you just drive away. It's like, it's still the same office. Again, I'm just trying to figure this out. Number three, he was using pure irony. Now, I kind of like this. He was being sarcastic. A true high priest would not give such an order. In other words, respect the high priest, respect the position. But when you start acting like this and you're just a whitewashed wall, you are under judgment. He's already written the Thessalonians. Remember, the letter of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians has already been written. It's like 10 years before, where he told them, he says, the Jewish, the punishment has already begun. He says the Jewish demise has already begun. And so, in other words, he sees us now as a culture that has been rejected by God. Jesus rejected it. Jesus rejected and says there's not going to be one stone left upon another. Paul had said a few years earlier that the judgment of the Jews had already begun. So he may have just been dismissing it. It's like, you're nobody. There's nothing left. You're no longer under the protection of God. When Jesus went to the cross, he said, what will men do? Men do this while the tree is green. What will they do when the tree has been cut down and it's dry? Paul may be referring to, this is just a facade. You are no longer really functioning as the high priest in God's will. You're condemned. Well, right here. God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You're already under judgment. It's over. So when he says, I shouldn't speak bad about the high priest, it's kind of like, I wouldn't if it was the real high priest, but this guy's an imposter. So I kind of like that because it helps explain Paul's cutting, sarcastic attitude. But, you know, that may not be right. It's just, I like that. The other one, he refused to acknowledge that Ananias was the high priest under these circumstances. It was kind of similar. He says, I'm rejecting his high priesthood. I'm not going to recognize it. So nonetheless, I'll read it one more time in the text there. And it's very interesting, again. Chapter 23, verse 1. Paul looks straight at the Sanhedrin and says, my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. And that was enough for the high priest, Ananias, ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law. Sure sounds like he thinks he knows what he's doing. Yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Those who are standing near Paul says, you dare to insult God's high priest? Paul replied, brothers, I did not realize that was the high priest, for it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. Like, is this your ruler? Okay, sarcastic. I don't know how you decide what you should do with it. Verse 6. Then Paul, knowing that some of them, that this is now Paul's playing, he's hitting below the belt here. I mean, he's up here. Well, you know what he's going to do. I'll set the stage for this. There's two major groups. Jesus came into contact, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees would be the conservative group. They're the ones that kind of came out of the Maccabean revolt as far as holding to the traditions, the law. They believed in the supernatural. They believed in life after death. They believed in angels. They believed in physical resurrection. The Sadducees also developed out of the Maccabean revolt, but they came out of the priests. The Pharisees were, in a sense, the people's group, the scribes, the scholars, those who were going after the truth, the Word of God, the traditions. The Sadducees came out of the priesthood, those who held on to the power. And indeed, the Maccabees themselves, or the Hasmoneans, were from the priestly line. And they're the ones that held the power, the political power. They held the money. And so they were the rich, and they became more of the liberal group. They rejected much of the Old Testament as being authentic on the same basis as the Law of Moses, or the first five books. So you've got the Sadducees are more liberal. They accept fewer books. And they do not believe in the supernatural. They don't believe in life after death. They don't believe in a resurrection. They don't believe in angels. None of that supernatural stuff. I mean, you can see these groups in our own culture today. You've got the conservative group over here, holding to the traditions. You've got the liberal group over here, kind of just holding on to the power in the contemporary sense. Now you put them together, say like in the Congress, or you put them together in the Sanhedrin, and you've got some over in scattered amongst the seats there. You've got some who believe in angels, the supernatural, eternal life, and resurrection. Then you've got the liberals scattered among them that just believe the here and the now and the money, that the power that we've got. They're all scattered, and that's who Paul's addressing. And Paul himself is a Pharisee. He was trained as a Pharisee. So now, once he gets done dressing down the high priest, he goes right to the group and drives a dagger, a sword, and divides the group. Again, it's brilliant strategy. Then Paul, knowing that some of them, in verse 6, some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out to the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. So he hasn't said much. All he said was, I stand before God with a good conscience and get slapped, mouse off the high priest. Then once he gets his footing back, he says, I'm a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee, and I'm here on trial because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Okay? When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, "We find nothing wrong with this man. That's good preaching. Amen. We agree with this guy." Well, the Sadducees are going, "Oh, that's a heresy. Let's kill him." So Paul instantly divides the crowd, and half of them are now, you know, polling on his side, and the other half is coming against him. And they say, "We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" The dispute became so violent, notice the word violent in the Sanhedrin, that the commander was afraid. The commander, the Roman commander, was afraid, because now you got the Jews, the Jewish leaders fighting with each other, was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He's not in the Temple Mount anymore. He's in with the Sanhedrin in a closed public building, and the Sanhedrin's tearing at him. He ordered the troops to go down and take Paul away from them by force and bring him back to the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and says, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify in Rome." Now is that not interesting? After all this, it's like, "Well, Paul, you did what you came to do. You preached on the Temple Mount for about this long. You made 5 statements in front of the Sanhedrin about that long. And now I'm taking you to Rome where I want you. Are you finished here, Paul?" I mean, it just kind of fits with the way I'm presenting it. You can disagree with that. But he tells Paul, it's like, okay, he says, "Take courage. Be encouraged. This is not where I necessarily wanted you, but we're all right. I'll turn this on. I'm gonna, just like you did what you did here, we're going to take you to Rome." Maybe this was God's plan, for him to testify one more time to the Jews. Maybe this was perfect. But this is now the next morning, day 10. He's been in Jerusalem 10 days. 7 of them were kind of hanging out waiting for his vow to be fulfilled. So that gives you 3 days. He's been through a church council that recommended him go to the Temple Mount. He's been through 2 riots. He's been arrested, almost beaten. And so of the 3 days that he wasn't taking a vow, it's been nothing but just chaos. But again, imagine Paul, the Temple Mount, talking to the Romans, the commander, talking to the Sanhedrin. That's 3 pretty full days of talking to important people. I mean, you show up in Jerusalem for 10 days, take 7 days off, and for 3 days you talk to everybody who's anybody in Jerusalem face to face. That's a pretty good 3 days there. So the next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. Now, if you ever see that coming in an email, that someone's taking an oath not to eat or drink until they kill you, you may want to get some backup help, because that's not a good sign. So there's Jews out serious about killing him. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priest, who's against Paul, and the elders, the Sanhedrin, and says, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the community," if they've taken an oath not to kill Paul and not eat until they have, that means they're on a very short timeline. I mean, they're like, you know, 2 or 3 days. They've got to get the thing done in 2 or 3 days, otherwise they're going to be in trouble. Verse 50, "Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petitioned the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about the case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here." So, high priest, you say, "We want to go send someone to the commander, have Paul brought before you, say you want to hear more information, and we'll assassinate him on the way." Now, this is, again, when he left Achaia, left Corinth, there was an assassination attempt. Now there's an assassination attempt going from the barracks, from Fort Antonia, down to where the Sanhedrin's meeting. Verse 16, "But when this is an interesting verse that's tucked in here. "But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul." So now Paul's got a sister living in Jerusalem. She's got a son. It's Paul's nephew. How old he is, I don't know. But he hears of this plot. He goes and visits Paul in the barracks and tells him, "Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, 'Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him.' So he took him to the commander." Now again, you say, why is he getting that kind of favoritism? A lot of times this kind of stuff would involve a bribe, you know, involve money. He's got something to tell the commander. And to take him, and what's it going to be? Maybe, "Well, we just have a little gift for you. Maybe you can help Paul out." And he drops some kind of a bribe or something. But nonetheless, that's not the case. in this situation. The centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner, sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man aside, drew him aside, and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." That's not going to be surprising because they saw what took place in the Temple Mount. They saw what took place in the Sanhedrin. And this is just, it makes complete sense. So they believe it. The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." Verse 23. Then he called two of his centurions. So now the commander up here in Fort Antonia calls two of his centurions, two guys over 100 men each, and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers. You've each got 100. Get your 200 men ready. 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight." They're going to ask for Paul to be taken here tomorrow morning. He says, "You're leaving at 9 o'clock tonight. Get ready. You've got a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." So now, this is where they're leaving Jerusalem, and they're going to go over to the sea, the 60 miles away, to Caesarea by the sea, to, again, where Herod the Great's palace was, that extended out into the sea, where the Hippodrome was at, where they had the racetrack, where the governor's mansion was at. That's where they're going to go. Paul's going to spend the next couple years there at that facility. He sends this letter along with him. So again, notice the Romans are the ones interested in protecting Paul, the Roman citizen, from the Jews. And they take a lot of inconvenience, a lot of manpower to get Paul from Jerusalem, travel 60 miles. And as you know, you're going to have to leave Jerusalem. You're going to be going uphill. Then you're going to go downhill onto the plain. Not hill. I mean, it's mountainous in a sense. It's mountains, not snow-capped mountains. But it's rough terrain coming up out of Jerusalem, peeking out, and then coming down on into the coastland. So it's going to be a hard 60-mile ride. Here's the letter. The commander, his name is now given in verse 25 and 26. He wrote the letter as follows. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias. That is the name of the Roman commander that's sending two cities. He's the one that's in here in Fort Antonia. And he's sending a letter and sending Paul to Felix, the governor, the Roman governor. And it says right here, to His Excellency. Now, it's worth noting, right here it says, to His Excellency. If you go back, just please humor me, go back to chapter 1 of Acts, chapter 1, verse 3. Excuse me, chapter 1, verse 1 is what I want. No, this would work. Yeah, I mean Luke. See, in chapter 1 of Acts, verse 1, in my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach. See that, Theophilus? Go to Luke. Luke is the first book. Luke chapter 1. Now, that's going to be chapter 1, verse 3. And notice what Luke calls Theophilus. The same writer of the book of Acts, who just addressed Governor Felix as to His Excellency. It's the same word that you see right here in chapter 1, verse 3. I'm going to read Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Please allow me. "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." Verse 3, "Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus." So right there, he's addressing Theophilus as most excellent, which is the same title he's addressing Governor Felix, His Excellency. Again, just kind of doesn't mean that Theophilus was a governor, but was probably high up in the government position, some kind of position of leadership, of wealth, of position of power. But nonetheless, we come back to Acts chapter 23, verse 24. Claudius Lysias writes, "To His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he is a Roman citizen." Notice how he's the hero of the story. the Jews were about to kill a Roman citizen on the Temple Mount. So I learned about it. I went down and rescued him. He went down and stopped the riot, arrested this guy, thinking he was a terrorist from Egypt. And while he's strapping him down to whip him, he found out that he's a Roman citizen. And he was almost afraid that he'd put him in chains. But it's interesting how he words it. It's like, oh, yeah. Well, let's read it again. This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him. But I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he is a Roman citizen. Those are all true statements, but there's some details missing in between. I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law. But there was no charge against them that deserved death or imprisonment. This has already been decided correctly by the commander. This is a matter of Jewish law. It has nothing to do with Roman law. He's already addressed it. Paul's going to spend 5 years to get that same decision. He's going to hear it from Festus. He's going to hear it from Felix. He's going to hear it from Herod Agrippa III. And then finally, he's going to hear it from Nero. It's all going to be the same thing. This has nothing to do with Roman law. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, again, he's a Roman citizen, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. So basically, I'm sending him to you for protection, and then I'm going to make those guys travel, the high priest and his Sanhedrin, travel 60 miles to Caesarea with their attorneys and their lawyers to bring a charge against the man I'm sending to you for protection. So remember, while Paul's in Caesarea prison, he's really being held there for protection and not punishments. The Romans are the ones who are protecting him, and they can't just let him go because they're ruling over the Jews. So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. That's 30 miles from Jerusalem. The next day, again, by that time, the Sanhedrin has no idea where Paul's at. They're waiting to go to ask for permission, and Paul's already halfway to Caesarea. The next day, they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. They figured they got him safe enough away from Jerusalem, and they returned. When the cavalry arrived at Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, which would be Felix, and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. And that Herod's palace is what I was referring to. You can see it going out into the you can still see the foundation of it, the walls. It goes out, extends out into the Mediterranean Sea. There's mosaics there, but there'd be some holding pen there, a prison inside the palace to hold prisoners for this. And that's where Paul's sitting, waiting for the trial. Now, chapter 24. We're not going to read this tonight. We'll pick up chapter 24 next week. It says, 5 days later, the high priest Ananias, that's the one who had Paul struck, went down to Caesarea with some of the elders of the elders, that's the Sanhedrin, and a lawyer named Tertullus. So now he brings his attorney down in Sanhedrin. And that 5 days later, that means 5 days after this dismissal from Jerusalem. So this would probably equal day 15. Paul's been in Jerusalem for 15 days now. So he's been in Caesarea where 15 days ago, the prophet Agabus came from Jerusalem out of Judah, came up to Caesarea, says, "So will the man whose belt, who belongs, who's this, so the owner of this belt will be bound as Agabus was born, bound." And Paul says, "I'm ready to die." Paul goes to Jerusalem, and within 2 weeks, he's right back, bound, right where Agabus says, "Don't go, you're going to get bound by the Jews and sent right back here." And guess what? 15 days later, it's exactly what Agabus said. So again, was that trip in vain? The money was delivered. Paul testified. Maybe it was. Maybe it was something God wanted. But it almost looks like the money could have been delivered without Paul. They've got the gospels being presented by other people there. Jesus left good people there in Jerusalem. Paul's to go to the Western world, but he wants to take one more shot at his people. Because they think, like, if I had one chance to talk to them. But anyway, 15 days later, we'll pick this up next week. 5 days later, the high priest went down there. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix, and we'll pick this up next week, and here's his first case. I got some names on the board. I was a little zealous tonight. Kind of excited to get to this. And I'll give you a heads up on this. You remember Herod the Great, and he had a son, Antiochus and other ones. But Herod Agrippa was his grandson. Herod Agrippa, that should be Herod Agrippa I. Herod Agrippa I was his grandson. Herod Agrippa is going to have a son named Herod Agrippa II. Herod Agrippa is the one who cut James's head off and then had put Peter in prison. He died in 44 A.D., eaten by worms in Caesarea, right here at the same palace there, Herod's his grandfather's palace. So he's dead. He's been dead since 44 A.D. He's got two daughters that we're going to know about, Bernice and this one called Drusilla. Herod Agrippa now was too young when his dad died in 44 A.D. He was like 17 to become like a leader, a governor, or a position. So they've been gradually giving him more and more territory. Basically, it's Galilee, it's the Golan Heights, a little bit of Perea, some other cities around in Galilee. So he's growing in power. Herod Agrippa II is going to show up and hear Paul talk. The first leader that we've got right there is Festus, or Felix, and he's going to be replaced by Festus. And I'll explain this more later. One of them, Felix, is going to be married to Drusilla, and he's going to become governor in 52 A.D. He was originally, that's the one who's there right now, he was originally a slave. Him and his brother were both slaves, worked their way out of slavery, became a free man, and he is now the governor of Judea when Paul arrives there in Caesarea. And he was married to Agrippa II's daughter, Drusilla. They're going to have a son, she's going to have a son. She's going to name Agrippa. This is just interesting. This is worthless information, but it's interesting. She's going to have a son. She's going to name Agrippa after her dad, who's going to die in Mount Vesuvius volcano explosion in 79 A.D. So there you've got Herod the Great. We're down to third generation, fourth generation, and the fifth generation that is wiped out in Vesuvius. Bernice is going to marry someone and then leave them. She was married like when she was like 16 or 14 or something, and come back and live the rest of her life with her brother, Herod Agrippa II. And they're going to travel together. History thinks they were basically a married couple. Not married legally, but married in, as far as living together. And so Herod, later on, when Felix leaves, Festus is going to replace him as the governor of Judea, of that area. And Herod Agrippa and Bernice are going to come down to welcome him, because this is the Jewish representation of the government. Felix, followed by Festus, is the Roman governor. And it's in their best interest that they get along. So when Felix is moved to another position, Festus replaces him, and that causes Herod Agrippa and Bernice, his sister, to come down and visit Festus. Now, it is at that time Paul is brought up, and he speaks to Festus, Bernice, and Herod Agrippa, and they hear the whole gospel message. That's all taking place. That's all coming up next week. So I'm going to pray. You're free to go. Thank you very much for listening. Father, we thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we may again put it in our hearts and use it for something that is guiding us today and to do the thing that you've called us to do. Just as Paul did the things you've called him to, we ask to be empowered by your Spirit and accomplish the things you've called us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.